going to open the Senate Education Committee today, February 21st. And just for people who are here who may not realize, we have one more committee meeting. That's next Monday. And then Tuesday, the second half of this is over. And if it's not out of this committee, it is dead. So there are a number of bills that could be sent to us from the House that may not get here in time. So then the Senate President will have to decide if he wants to send it to, the ultimate committee, the Revenue Committee, or the Standby Committee, the Rules Committee. But they're going to have to go someplace else. That's one of the inefficiencies or one of the issues with respect to short sessions. It goes by very, very quickly, and I just wanted to make sure everybody knows. So we're, in general, especially first-time bills in the Senate, we like to leave them on the desk for a day and then come back and vote them out. But in the second half, we basically, if we can all agree, we're going to move them out because we don't need to have whatever comes to us on Monday plus some of these left over. So just want to let people know that's a little bit of a change. I don't particularly like doing that, but most of these today are, I think, are pretty easy that way. So with that, we will open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 4153. And one of our bills got posted late, so we have to go till 2. So we were expecting a good half hour, 45-minute presentation by the East Norrie people. So with that, we're going to open that public hearing and work session.
You should have never said that.
And we'll let Lisa give a short explanation. And the illustrious group of people who want to come forward, we made sure there were 3 chairs for you. So come on up.
I'll do my best. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 4153 designates Eastern Oregon University as Oregon's rural university.
And we're going to ask her to speak as short as she can, because we would like her to have a little bit of voice left after the session.
Yeah.
That was great.
For an hour and a half.
So.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Hansel, State Senator for Senate District 29, Northeast and North Central Oregon, also the home of Eastern Oregon University. I come before you today as chief sponsor and urge the passage of House Bill 4153, a bill to designate Eastern Oregon University as Oregon's rural university. With this bill, Eastern will have the official designation, which will allow EOU to both have additional appeal to potential students from across the nation, and also this official designation can be used to help leverage federal funds. Eastern Oregon University has served rural Oregon since its founding in 1929. Eastern Oregon University is located in rural Oregon, and its graduates are living and serving throughout our state. This bill passed out of the House unanimously last week, and I look forward to the bill passing out of the Senate with a similar vote count. Thank you, Chair Roblin and committee, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
I think we'll go through the whole. I just have one question, but isn't this in La Grande? I thought you said it was rural. That's one of the biggest.
It's a city.
It's a big city in the Eastern Oregon. There are not that many bigger cities. We can leave that for now.
I can answer that. Hermiston is much bigger. Thank you, Chair Roblin and committee. For the record, my name is Greg Barreto, representative from House District 58. And I'm happy to come here today alongside Senator Hansel, President Insko, and also Vice President Tim Seidel in support of House Bill 4153 to designate Eastern Oregon University as Oregon's designated rural university. Serving rural communities is not only the mission of Eastern Oregon University, but it is also one of the core principles the institution does very well. By receiving this designation, EOU will be in a position to leverage and secure very important additional federal funds for education. This bill passed unanimously, both out of the House committee and on the House floor, and this is a great bill for Eastern Oregon University and for the state. And I thank you for hearing this bill and working this bill and passing this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Does this mean I have an hour and 25 minutes?
they did theirs very quickly, so you got some time.
Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Lithencombe, and members of the committee, thank you first for your service to the state of Oregon and the opportunity to speak on the importance of House Bill 4153. It is fantastic, actually, to have one of your committee members here that is a former ASEOU student body president. of EOU, Senator Bentz. So good to have you here as well. I want to speak briefly about why designating Eastern Oregon University as Oregon's rural university is an important action you can take that will advance academic and economic opportunities for the eastern part of our state. For the record, I'm Tom Insko, president of Eastern Oregon University. I'm native of Eastern Oregon, and I grew up on a farm outside of La Grande. I'm a graduate of Eastern Oregon University and resided in Northeast Oregon for much of my career working for a wood products company, Boise Cascade Company, for approximately 20 years prior to becoming president of EOU in July of 2015. We've made significant progress over the last 3 years, moving from a university with financial uncertainty to solid financial ground. Our future is bright, and the designation we are requesting will further support our progress to provide more opportunities to higher education and economic prosperity to students across the state. Specifically, today I'd like to speak about three things relating to this designation. One, why is EOU distinctly rural? Two, how does this support our ability to access additional funding sources? And three, how it is consistent with enhancing our long-term strategy as an institution. So let me give you a little context. As much as I'd like to say I cherish the 320-mile drive this morning from La Grande, it is a long ways away from what people would say are urban population centers. EOU is located in La Grande. It's 250 miles to the nearest Oregon community with more than 20,000 students or residents. Gresham is the closest community to La Grande with over 20,000 residents. If you allow yourself to cross state borders, it's about 120 miles. And I would suggest that being a university in a sparsely populated region as EOU is, it does create a distinction in terms of the types of relationships that we have with our community partners and the school districts and such in Eastern Oregon. We are sparsely populated. We have tremendous relationships with our communities. And we also have the highest proportion of Pell-eligible students relative to the other public universities in the state of Oregon. And this is partly due to the economic challenges Eastern Oregon has endured in the last several decades. I also want to provide context of the connectivity of EOU to our communities that I believe is distinct because of our sparse population. And I'm going to use Grant County School District as our example. In Grant County School District, 56% of the public school teachers and staff are graduates of EOU, so well more than half. Specifically, at Humboldt Elementary School, which is in Grant, 70% of the teachers and staff are EOU alumni. We're an extremely important partner to education in Eastern Oregon. Our roots are deep with community partners in close proximity. But looking beyond our immediate communities, we serve rural students across the state as well. And so when you look at our Oregon resident students, 77% are from zip codes designated as rural communities as defined by Oregon Rural Health. We definitely have a rural mission as an institution. We also have 11 centers distributed across Oregon, running from Ontario to Burns to Roseburg, where we have a distinct mission of meeting students where they are. And many of these students are adult students in these small rural communities. So how does this support access to additional funding sources? We're really looking to position EOU to be a catalyst for positive advancement for rural communities. There are many ways to accomplish this goal, and by designating EOU as Oregon's rural university, it better positions us to qualify and compete for federal and private grant funding focused on addressing these challenges that rural communities face. Simply, this designation positions us to potentially benefit from funding that today we do not have access to. Why does it enhance our long-term strategy? We have recently completed a long-term strategic plan where one of the six goals at Eastern Oregon University is to serve as the educational, cultural, and economic engine for rural places. We're committed to focusing on creating positive change in areas of the state that are facing unique challenges. Rural designation helps us to continue and expand on our many existing rural initiatives. We already have great educational partnerships such as Eastern Promise, which some of you probably know about, our Oregon Teacher Pathway program that is growing and developing the next generation of educators who will be more culturally responsive to the changing demographics of rural Oregon. We work closely with community college partners on dual enrollment and fast track partnerships that provide access to efficient 2+2 models for students. We have a deep and long-standing partner in OHSU and OSU, where we work to provide rural students with opportunities to pursue a career in nursing or access to the excellent agriculture and natural resource programs that OSU offers. We are also establishing the Rural Engagement and Vitality Center, the REV Center, and it's dedicated to promoting rural prosperity and revitalization by connecting our institution to the needs of Oregon's rural communities. In closing, designating Eastern Oregon University as Oregon's rural university achieves the following. It acknowledges the distinct rural characteristics of our institution. It recognizes EOU's role as an institution of access and opportunity, particularly for students in low population density areas. It provides a meaningful mechanism for securing additional funding for rural initiatives, and it assists EOU in advancing our mission and strategy to serve as the educational, cultural, and economic engine for rural communities. Thank you for your time, and I urge your support for this important designation.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes.
Could you give one example, two examples of what you meant when, if you get this designation, you'd be able to go after some federal grants or federal. What's out there for rural schools with this designation?
Yeah, both at I'll speak at the public level. So at the federal level, USDA has a number of granting opportunities over time where it's focused on rural initiatives, rural community development programs. And rather than EOU having to demonstrate through a lengthy process that we serve rural communities, this designation essentially is something we would look to point at as the state has designated us as serving rural communities. Obviously, it'd have a tremendous impact, too, with private philanthropic organizations that are also looking to who can they partner with to initiate programs in rural Oregon or beyond.
Okay, thanks. Other questions? I guess my question is, I appreciate Eastern Oregon for a whole lot of reasons, but one of them is that you chose to make a connection with a community college and a university center in the alma mater of the person sitting next to you, Mr. Barreto. So Southwestern has a university center, which has produced a number of teachers that stayed in our rural area because of the connection with Eastern Oregon University. So I really appreciate that outreach that you have done, at least there. We had hoped it would be a model, but it stayed just Eastern and SWAC. Other schools have come into that, but thank you for that. Yes.
President Isco, you had fun with the item with regard to distances to major metropolitan areas and whatever, and we were making fun of a neighborhood very close to Rep. Barreto in terms of being the metropolitan center. In one of the whereas clauses, it says first university to develop distance education programs. Can you give us insight into some of your offline or off-campus education and technology instituted programs or whatever? Because by distance education, I realize it's not all in the wagon and buggy arena, but there's a program associated with distance learning.
Yes, actually, Eastern's history in distance education dates back more than 30 years. I know this well. My dad was actually the dean of distance education for a number of years at EOU. And because of our location, Eastern was it literally was a pioneer of distance ed across the nation, where the university was engaging in the use of new technologies to, again, meet students where they are, because it is a challenge in sparsely populated communities to provide that educational opportunity that urban centers can provide. And so our history goes back more than 30 years. Obviously, technology has developed, and with the internet and such, the way we deployed education 30 plus years ago relative today is very different. However, the majority of our undergraduate degrees today have both an on-campus program and an online program. So we have students, I know we're talking about Oregon, but we literally have students that benefit from our online delivery that reside in Florida, so clear across the nation. And we see that as something we're going to continue to grow aggressively, because there's a huge adult population that is lacking in higher education that has those needs, and so we're going to leverage those existing undergraduate programs, and we have a one graduate program that's delivered online to continue to expand.
Thank you.
Thank you. So, yes, the president, the ex-president.
Yeah, the former president.
Former president.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that remark, President Insko. You know, I ran for student body president years ago because the winner had the tuition paid. I'm not lying. And so I think in relative terms, I was doing far better back then than I am now. But I digress.
Absolutely.
So one of the things I've done as I've traveled from town to town in that vast part of the state is and sit down with folks and discuss with them their economic futures. I say to them, look around you and take an inventory of what you've got. And that's exactly what you guys have done. And you've suddenly recognized that you needed to build upon that which is most obvious, the rural nature of that space. And so I think it's genius what you're doing. I think it's great, because most people would look at rural and look down their noses at it. What you've done is turned that around. And so I think you're to be commended for the genius of it. And so I'm happy to support this bill.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to thanks, Mr. Chair. I wanted to follow up on the mention of the online component, because one of the things I've appreciated about Eastern is they have centers all over the state to support the online students. You know, and I think having that physical presence was one at the college that I taught at for many years. And so we had many of our community college graduates or simultaneously enroll with Eastern programs. And so in your own way, I think you have your college, your university is healing the urban-rural divide, right? And I will say that when I last visited the campus, it was with Senator Hansel. We had a great great tour of the campus, and it's a beautiful campus, and I just, you know, I appreciate the online partnership, but I really wish that more urban kids would go out there and actually have that experience of living in LeGrand and, you know, seeing what it's like to live in a rural part of the state.
Yeah, if I might comment, we're actually working with Portland State's National Policy Consensus Center on developing a program where we would have students both come from our LeGrand campus and spend time at PSU and vice versa. I share my grandiose vision as EOU plays a significant role in breaking down that rural-urban divide. I think we are appropriately positioned to do that if we execute well.
Okay. Last two things I would say. One is that in order for me to get my standard teaching certificate, the only place that offered the particular course I had on a weekend was LeGrand. So I got to drive from Coos Bay to LeGrand. I got to see most of the state on a weekend, take a course, and drive all the way back. But it was I had a better appreciation for your drive today. And the last thing is, you said it was Humboldt, the elementary school. So make sure those kids understand that's the most used person's name, naming places in the world. There is no second place. It is Humboldt. Mm. And it is all because of an 18th century scientist out of Germany, Alexander von Humboldt, who is the father of today's ecology, to all sorts of different kinds of things. So they should look up Alexander von Humboldt and study where the name from their school came from, because it's pretty amazing, actually. So thank you for being here. Any other questions or thoughts? So, yes.
I was just going to say that we did not exchange our dress code before we came here today. We looked like the Blues Brothers, but we did not purposely do that.
We were not commenting on you wearing your duck colors every day. Well, we weren't going to, but anyway, thank you. If you want to stay around, we're probably going to take a vote right now. So,
Thank you.
I don't need to close public. We've already worked in the work session. So, Senator Lithicum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House Bill 4153 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Lithicum moves House Bill 4153 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Any conversation, input people would like to make now? Seeing none, any opposition? So moved. Move off to the floor. Senator Benz, you want to carry? Okay. Well, that was very nice of you to defer to Senator Hansel. Okay.
Maybe he won't be wearing the dumb colors. Hope.
Yeah. Senator Hansel, you want to carry it?
I would be honored.
We'll have you carry it then. And thank you. With that, we'll close our work session and our public hearing on House Bill 4153. We're going to open a public hearing and work session on HCR 206. So we'll do that. There is one amendment, but we'll talk about that later. So we'll bring up Simon Burdage and Justin Burnett. It hasn't been posted. We didn't post the amendment.
You didn't post the amendment?
No. But we did that. We do have an amendment that came in as well. We'll mention it in a second.
Oh, I get it.
With that,
better sense of humor.
I guess we could tell it now. I mean, there is an amendment for this one, and we should have waited before Hansel left. That has the last two words.
You missed it. He left.
The last word in the deal has go Beavs, and there is an amendment to change that to go Ducks, just so you know. But we'll let you address that if you want.
Shucks.
So with that, we'll let you speak to this resolution. And we'll have a short explanation of the resolution.
Really?
You don't have to talk about it. We'll let you explain the resolution. We'll keep her voice going. So,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I wanted to thank you first for having us here. We really appreciate the opportunity. My name is Simon Brundage. I am the current president of the Associated Students of Oregon State University. As of a couple days ago, I'm also the lame duck president of the Associated Students of Oregon State University, with the president-elect sitting next to me. All the same, I like to think that I have a little bit of valuable input still to provide. Jock might disagree with me, but I still do have something to say about my time with Oregon State. When I arrived at Oregon State University as a freshman about 3.5 years ago, I was a very introverted person. I had a lot of social anxiety, depression, a lot of different conditions that definitely are pretty characteristic of coming out of high school and transitioning into a college atmosphere. I definitely didn't spend a lot of time with friends originally. I didn't spend a lot of time getting involved in clubs. I was really focused on Oregon State for academics, for engineering. I'm a radiation health physics major, so the nuclear reactor on campus was a big draw to me. But aside from those academic facets, I was really not particularly interested in other aspects of the university system. That said, the more I got immersed in the community and the more I met students within the residence halls, members of the ASOSU, members of different engineering clubs, the more I found myself. I found a lot of the things I was really keenly interested in. It really drew upon me a part I really had never connected with in high school. It brought me to a more leadership place, altruistic place, something where I realized that I had a dedication for public service and giving back to the community. And that was not something that had existed prior to the inception of my education at Oregon State. And I think it took a really unique community, a really unique atmosphere to draw out that kind of spirit and interest. And even to this day, once I graduate from Oregon State at the end of the year, I fully plan on staying committed to the school and giving back in whatever way I possibly can. I also want to touch on briefly what it means to be president during the 150th anniversary of Oregon State University. Effectively sitting at the pinnacle of 150 years of academic excellence, innovation, and realistically just an education that spans much deeper than academics and goes into your extracurriculars, the friends that you make, the peers that you meet. Those are all extremely unique experiences, and to be here at the 150th anniversary and to look back at the legacy that we've left, it is truly an honor. And I dare say that my experience as ASOSU president has been the most distinct honor of my life, and I hope that one day I can give back to the school in the way that it has given me these kinds of opportunities. I also, the last thing I want to leave you all with is the unique relationship between students and the administration of Oregon State. I want to say that in my time as ASOSU president, I've had the unique opportunity to meet different members of the administration. And in my experience, I've met nothing short than people who are dedicated to giving back to students and giving students the education that they deserve in the times that we live in. I think that that is a really unique thing to Oregon State. I think that the relationship that we have with them, the transparency in the student fee process, the transparency in the tuition setting process, it is truly an Oregon State University thing. And I think that the school as a whole deserves to be honored for those kinds of incredible commitments to students. Aside from that, though, I strongly urge a vote in favor of 206. It's been truly an honor to be here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Roblin and other members of the committee. For the record, my name is Justin Bennett. I'm currently the president-elect of ASOSU, and it is exciting. I'll be working with Simon transitioning over these next couple of months. So I just want to say thank you for having me, and I just wanted to talk a little bit about my experience at OSU these past 3 years and the way that it's shaped me into wanting to be someone who felt that they could run for the president. I'm a first-generation college student, and so the thought of college at first was really intimidating. Not only is OSU three times larger than the town that I came from, I come from Cottage Grove, it also, the professors make more than any of my parents have ever made. It is also one of the most diverse places I've ever lived. Coming from Cottage Grove, where probably we have more churches than we do people, we're famous for our covered bridges, and we're also famous for our main street scene in Animal House, which some of you may have seen. So coming to OSU was a pretty big change from coming from a small town just under 10,000 people. And so I was definitely someone, when I came to this campus, I was pretty confused about where exactly I was supposed to fit into that. Since my parents had never gone to college, they didn't necessarily know how to advise me, and they weren't necessarily sure what I was supposed to be doing. So I felt in a certain way that I was definitely thrown into the deep end and had to swim. What I realized at OSU, and what I realized I was thinking that I was looking for this entire time, was the thing that had originally made me love growing up in such a small town. And for me, that was that sense of community. Being in such a small town, you get to know everyone, you grow up with them your entire lives, and moving away, even only an hour away from Cottage Grove, that was really, really scary. This thought that maybe I wouldn't all of a sudden know these people that I had known for 18 years of my life. But I'm really, really happy to say that I realized that this sense of community and this sense of belonging could be found at OSU, even something that was three times the size of where I was from. And I realized quite suddenly that community isn't necessarily just about knowing people or being known, but it's really about making the experiences around you count and making sure that you're part of an organization that's moving forward. So I'm really excited to be, one, now on this other side of the 150th anniversary, now setting this legacy moving forward into the 151st. And I think it really says something about the ability of OSU to bring in so many diverse students and to be able to move forward as a community. I can say without a doubt that my confidence from high school moving into college has grown tenfold. I never would have thought that I would be able to run for president in high school. And I really just want to say thank you so much for considering this, and I also want to say thank you for recognizing the importance of 150 years of really, really great success, and hopefully we can have 150 years more of a great success as well. Thank you so much.
Any questions? I think you should ask Senator Bence about tuition to your university. He had a good deal when he went to school.
Yeah, well, I work for it, Mr. Chair.
Oh! Fair enough,
yes. If only the tuition at OSU were the same as it was when we were in college.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So just out of curiosity, do they, miserly folks that they are down at OSU, pay you guys' tuition if you are student body president?
Well, so technically, we're paid a stipend of about $13.50 per hour, and I would say it adds up probably to around what in-state tuition would be for
a student.
That's pretty
close.
If only we were paid that amount.
A fair statement.
Yeah.
And the other thing I'd say, Cottage Grove. 4A yeah. state football champions.
Yeah, I know. Isn't it awesome? Very cool.
I mean, I can't believe you.
Yeah, that's the first time in Cottage Grove history.
And the coach went to, I don't know, Marshfield High School. Just he's an old student of mine, so it's kind of fun. And he beat Marshfield, which was really nice too. So just to point out some of the fun little things that happen in Oregon. And we do appreciate Oregon State University.
Yeah,
so, with that, I will take a motion. Now, any more people on that? Jock, did you want to come up and speak? Did anybody from the higher ed system want to speak? Checking out there, see. I do want to give an offer to anybody that's sitting there that is waiting and wants to come up and speak. They can now. Okay, they don't.
Sweet.
So
thank you so
you
much.
Very much.
Thanks.
So with that, I would entertain a motion.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. I would like to move HCR 206 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
So Senator Lithgow moves HCR 206 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Any further discussion? I would say that in the House, they had a old student body president that was also from Marshall, Mr. Clem, and he probably said something when you were over there, because he always takes that opportunity.
I've never heard him say anything.
Exactly. No discussion. Any opposition to the motion to be adopted? Seeing none, so passes, and we will move that on to the floor. Who would like to carry this one? I know there's at least one Oregon State.
I live in Beaver Nation. Could I?
Yes, we'll give this one to Senator Gelser, since she lives in Beaver Nation.
I mean, we all live in Beaver Nation.
Oh, okay, let's be clear. Yes. So with that, we're going to close the public hearing and work session on HCR 206, and we're going to open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 4036A. And who do we have? Morgan Allen. Come on up. Do you want to say anything about this? Should we keep your voice? Can you explain it so we don't have to have our person use their voice?
I could.
Sorry.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Morgan Allen on behalf of the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. If you remember last session, Senate Bill 208, which this committee had quite a debate about, related to charter school and homeschool students participating in OSAA activities. That bill passed and cleared the way for the Department of Education to make rulemaking that allows students in grades 9 through 12, if they attend a charter school or are a homeschool student, to participate in the sports or other related OSAA-related activities at their neighborhood high school in their school district. And during the interim period, there have been some issues arise in districts around whether or not homeschool and charter school students are allowed to participate in before or after school activities at middle school. It's very easy at the high school level, and I think the department did a good job on the rules, although not everyone agreed, but that's usually the signs of a good middle ground, because there's a governing body, the Oregon Student Activities Association regulates. There's rules for who gets to participate. There's a system that makes sense, but often in K-8, you know, there's some schools have before and after school activities. Like my daughter's middle school has some sports, but other sports are through the Boys Club or YMCA, other things like that. So House Bill 4036 does something really simple. from our perspective. It was a compromise bill in the House. It adds before and after school activities in grades K through 8 and allows charter school and homeschool students to participate in those at their resident neighborhood school. So our goal with the bill and the amendment in the Ann Gross version was to, we felt like the high school issue was settled. That happened in 208 and through the rulemaking process, and that's governed by the OSAA rules. And then this bill adds before and after school activities. So if a school district has a track and field team at their middle school, for example, or an after school chess club, or a before school choir program, and a charter school or homeschool student would like to participate in that, they have the same opportunity as the students that attend that school. So we would urge your passage of the bill.
Any questions? Yes, Senator Benz.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have a challenge in Ontario with our charter school. It's highly successful. It's doing a fine job. The difficulty arises from the fact that it's a small community, and when you separate into different groups, the total amount available for each is diminished. And thus, when this bill came along a year ago, I voted against it initially, and when it came back, it had some control features in it, so that allowed me to vote for it reluctantly. It's awkward because the chief sponsor is Mike McLean, who's a very close friend, and I understand his reasons for bringing this bill. I was just asking members of the committee what the ADM average is across the state. I believe it's between $8,000 to $9,000, and this is set up so that in the event someone wants to move from a charter school to a public school, 5%, up to 5% of the ADM can be sent over about $450. In situations like we have in Ontario, this is very awkward. It's awkward for all kinds of reasons, the money being perhaps the least of them. But one of the things I do not like about this bill as crafted is that it puts a lid on what can be charged for a now and very significantly increased scope of activity. And so having access seems to me to be something that should happen. How much it costs is something that needs to be addressed with more clarity. The other point I would make, it's a very awkward situation as I've observed it. When we have a charter school that's not sponsored by the local district, which is the case in Ontario, mm-hmm. It's sponsored by the state. And therefore, the opportunities, if there are any, because I'm simply not sufficiently familiar with how these systems work, to manage through these situations in a way that takes into account that which the public school is obliged to do, as compared to that which the charter or other school is not, is challenging, Mr. Chair. And so, although I'm supportive of the expansion, I'm concerned about our not having addressed the cost, and because there are many, and this is a much larger issue. But in this narrow space, I think I'll confine my remarks to saying we need to address that part of it. Now, we could come back a year from now with the understanding that we're going to, or we could address it now, and say they're supposed to enter into a contract, as I see it here, to try to work this out. But there's a lid. So what happens if it costs more? How is that going to be addressed? That's the long way to get to that question.
Mr. Chair and Senator Benz, I think you've addressed a lot of the questions that have been discussed in the rulemaking process and in the discussions around Senate Bill 208. And I'm very familiar, the superintendent in Ontario, I've spoke on many occasions about the situation in Ontario. And I think what I would say to answer your question is I fully expect that there will be legislation probably brought forward, potentially by some of the charter folks, potentially by some House members, around this issue of which you've raised, which is classes. And the original bill and the original rules, as you know, only apply to OSAA-sanctioned activities, which is mostly sports or things like speech and debate. And in some instances, the rules allow for, if there's a course for credit, that the district would be able to enroll the student and charge some of the amount, not the full equivalent of the ATM of that class, but up to 5%, as you pointed out. That is a really thorny issue for our folks. And I think if the charter folks were up here or the other associations, OSBA and OEA, well, there's a broad difference of opinion about that issue. And so we tried to confine House Bill 4036 just to before and after school activities, because that question of classes and the regular school day and who gets the ADMW is one of the oldest fights in the building. And so we tried to circumvent that by sticking to just the before and after school activities, which are much more limited in the K-8 realm as compared to high schools. And that's why I think you see a real narrow build this session. And that's why we frankly hoped, we did not want to reopen that question around the high schools because the bill passed, Senate Bill 208, the Department of Education did the rules. In my opinion, nobody was happy, 100%. Generally a good sign that it's a good middle ground. And then we wanted to avoid a lot of the questions that you have appropriately raised with this piece of legislation. But I fully expect we'll be back here in 2019 debating this issue about who gets to go to classes and who pays.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Well, thank you for that answer. Tell me what information you could share with us when it comes to the value or cost of these before and after school activities per student.
Yeah, so thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bence, I think it varies greatly. It could be, you know, a few dollars to a sport, maybe a few hundred dollars it costs the school to hire coaches and athletic trainers and other things. So I think it varies very widely.
The obvious follow-up, Mr. Chair, is do, other than your best guess, do you have a study? Do you have some work done on this? Or from what source do you derive your response?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bence, unfortunately, the often relied on anecdotal resource when you talk to school district folks. And I think, you know, just to make a general comment about the activities and sports, 5% is probably closer to the true cost. Some sports that require a lot of equipment or, you know, like football, for example, has very expensive equipment, can cost more. A lot of schools also have, you know, things like track where they don't, or swimming where anybody's allowed to participate. So there's sort of no added cost if more students participate because they're no-cut sports. And it really depends on the activity. The issue when you talk about cost for classes is a little bit different. And I'll just give you one example to kind of show you the rabbit holes you can go down. Currently under Oregon law, if a homeschool student asks their resident school district to participate in a class, let's say they want to take an AP history class, but they're a registered homeschool student, the school district may, at their discretion, choose to enroll that homeschool student in the AP history course, and they get the equivalent of the ADMW for that student. So let's say it's a high school with a 6-period day, the school district, by enrolling that homeschool student in the AP social studies course or history course, would get 1/6 of the ADMW for that student, which is the ADM, like you said, it's about $8,000, I think it's $7,600. So the under the original bill and the original rules, it's capped at 5%, which is not an equivalent amount, for example, for the activity. So it is a very thorny issue.
My last follow-up, Mr. Chair. The challenge, of course, is not limited to the cost. There is the challenge to those who are trying to control the kids that might come over, that they have tools available when that child is going to the school that is offering the activity. Those opportunities for controlling disruptive kids or other things are not necessarily available when they're coming from an outside school. So there's costs that go with what is so simply placed in this bill that are not necessarily being taken into account. We could call it all kinds of things, but there's costs. And so to limit this to just an ADM discussion is certainly inadequate. So I guess what I'm saying, as I look at this bill, it's challenging to me because it looks to me as if it's approaching a very complex situation in a pretty meat cleaver way. So I would kind of say it. Now, it doesn't mean I'm going to vote against it, but I'm extremely concerned about, I guess, what the rules are going to look like. You're going to now engage if this thing passes. But the good thing about it is I hope to be back next year, and we can see how it's going.
Thank you for the comments, Senator Bence. Part of the reason I came up here today is hopefully to try to help establish some of that legislative intent that there are a lot of issues that are still question marks for a lot of people, depending on your perspective, and that with this, we wanted to solve one problem that we felt like we could solve reasonably in February, which was to clarify that if it's a before or after school activity that's not a class or part of the regular school day, the homeschool or charter school student could participate in that. And we'll leave the thornier questions to 2019.
Other questions?
I do, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. I welcome that larger discussion because I think it's probably overdue. But again, you know, with respect to the, sorry to get back to the ADMW, but so this only applies to charter kids. It doesn't apply to homeschool kids.
No, Mr. Chair, Senator Dembrough does apply to homeschool students as well.
So then how does that work in terms of the ADMW there?
Yeah, so Mr. Chair and Senator Dembrough, this is my understanding. So the bill, if you look at it, talks about the charter school paying the school district and ADMW. But since the homeschool student would not be taking a class in this instance, they would not receive any money for allowing that student to participate in the extracurricular activity. If I remember correctly, the Department of Ed in their rulemaking for the original bill at the high school level, if a school district charges a sports participation fee, for example, I believe the homeschool student and the charter school student would still be required to pay that. I think the one thing that everyone does agree on, and again, this is can be a very contentious issue, I think the one thing that everyone can agree on is that if we're going to do this, we want to treat the kids the same. So if they have to try out for the team, you know, or there's cuts, or there's fees or other things like that, we want to make sure the students are treated the same, in the same fashion.
Right, but I guess, you know, just following up, you know, in terms of, you know, the support that's coming to the school, the homeschool kids and the charter kids are not being treated the same, right?
That's correct, yes.
And that seems problematic. I mean, was there any talk about how other ways to address that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Dembrough. I think given the discussions and the contentiousness of this nature, I'm going to go back to my default answer, which is I expect this is going to be something that we'll have to talk more about in 2019. But we attempted to solve a problem as narrowly as possible this session without opening up that issue around payment back up.
And so going back to the situation of a charter school, so if a kid wants to do a before or after school activity, presumably the charter school would have to agree to that, right, since they're paying for it?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dembrough, my understanding is that the charter school could not prohibit the student from participating either at the OSAA-sanctioned activity at high school or in the before or after school activity. What is at the discretion of the school district would be whether or not they want to charge the fee. It's allowed to be up to 5%. They do not have to charge the full 5%. They could charge a lesser amount or a prorated amount depending on the activity. But they're allowed to charge up to 5%. But that is for an unlimited number of activities. So if you do chess club, the district could theoretically ask the charter school for 5%. If the student participated in three or four clubs or before sports activities, et cetera, it's still capped at 5%.
Sure. Just if I could just follow up one more time.
Yeah.
Were the charter schools involved in the, you know, creation of this bill? Are they okay with that, being able to be, you know, to lose that amount of their ADMW with not having control over it?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dembrough, I'm in a little bit of an awkward position because I was only tangentially involved in the legislation last session. I did participate in the rulemaking process. I think it would be fair to say that school district folks would like to charge more for classes, and the charter folks think there should be tighter caps on how much that the districts can charge the charter schools.
And they were both involved
in
classes.
I'm shocked.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Senator?
Just to follow up on in this same vein, but whatever that is, whether it's the full 5% or whatever, that's an agreed upon written agreement document or something between the charter school and this, you know, and the school itself with regard to probably identifying the number of students or just open-ended or just fixed fee, 4.5%, 5%, whatever that looks like. That's still a negotiated or agreed upon value for that time and effort, correct?
Mr. Chair and Senator Linthicum, I do not know the exact answer to that. My recollection is that the school district gets to decide what the fee is. It's not a negotiation where the charter school says we'll pay 2% and the district says, well, we want 2.5% and then let's do 2.25%. My recollection is that the school district has the say over the percentage charged. And they can do 0 to 5, but they have the charter school is obligated to pay it under the statute. This is my understanding. I know OD's right. In the room.
And there's just a cap at the 5.
That's correct.
Okay. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gelfand. I noticed this bill is not brought on behalf of COSA. Are any of the bill's sponsors here to kind of answer the questions about the bill development and what's
It may be on the floor.
Okay. I hate to leave working in the hot seat as a participant and not the bringer of the bringer of the bill.
Yeah. I will I will say that, and I don't have any questions for you. I'll just make the comment that Senator McLean did come over and talk to me a long time about the bill. Representative McLean, thank you. Representative McLean came over and talked about why and what happened and that, and I can share that if the group would like to have it. For most of us in the rural areas, we don't have any before and after school programs. They went away a long time ago. Our Boys and Girls Club provide all of them. We don't have a lot of the sports and other kinds of things. So it's gone to Boys and Girls Clubs and to other organizations providing those. So for a lot of people, it's kind of like, well, anybody can do that. So they are mixed with everybody in a lot of our communities. So this came about, I think, because of a choir program in some district. And that it come out and found out the student was not able to participate. And so Senator McLean felt very strongly Representative McLean felt very strongly about the idea that this is all of our communities. We all pay property taxes that fund the schools. There's a lot of other kinds of costs that are coming in and out of school districts. And so from his perspective, because we were not talking about classes, we're just talking about those extracurricular activities. Everybody who is in that community is paying for some of those activities because the state doesn't pay any money per student for those activities. They talk about the academic portions, those non-academic after school and other programs. Come out of the same money. They come out of the same money for sure. And so districts have to make decisions about that. But I think his feeling was you have a community of kids, and therefore should they get to participate in these programs? And his feeling was yes, that's why this bill got written. And I think there have been some negotiations about it in between, over in the House, quite a few, that led to the final bill the way it is written, because it was different than that to begin with. Some places will not be affected because of the fact they don't offer those kind of things at the middle school. And a number of them that are offered at middle schools, we've had to have the conversation about can chess club use the facility because it's a parent group that's bringing in and brings the coach in and they don't charge anything and they have it and the school districts have worked out ways to say, yeah, you can use it for those activities anyway because they're not paying a coach or anything for most of those activities. Some school districts still do, and we used to do a lot of that at one time in our school district. And I think it would be a bigger conversation had there been more of that happening in a lot of those districts. But most districts don't do a lot at the middle school anymore.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll just make my last comment, as I should have maybe said this at the beginning. My attempt was to just try to explain and represent what the compromise was. COSA, we had some issues with the original bill. We tried to negotiate a middle ground. Our members have some real strong concerns around classes. And we're trying to draw a bright line between sports and before and after school activities and classes. And there's a big difference from our perspective. And we can talk about that in 2019.
That's true. And so these are those other activities that oftentimes they fundraise and do other activities for and often sometimes charge, sometimes don't. So that's the issue.
Mr. Chair, I'll just say I'm very sympathetic to the goals here, but I'm just not sure that bringing in the ADMW questions and all that, that it wouldn't be better to wait and deal with this more comprehensively is, my sense. I'm not sure that the urgency is there, and we could end up doing something and then next year redoing it, and I'm not sure that really addresses the need.
So I will, yes, Senator Lipscomb.
Just a comment with that regard. The difference between those before and after school activities and the classes issue, I don't see the ADM 5% number as quite frankly, what we'll see is we'll just see 5%. Nobody's going to bother saying, well, that's only 3%. They're all just going to go for the max. And I can't blame anybody for doing that, but it'll just be the 5% number because there's no reason not to, and that's where the cap is. But there's a big difference between those, quote, classes in the scholastic academic arena and the after school. And if there's choir or chess and the charter school is still doing the 5%, then that there's clearly a more than sufficient funding stream to take care of that student who also might want to, you know, be in some other academic setting. So I don't think that what we're going to see is charter school individuals who have adopted the charter school mentality and are enjoying the education opportunity that the charter school presents, whatever that might be, all of a sudden, you know, running back over to the public school because this is where all the, you know, the quality classroom arena is taking place. So I don't think we really have to dissect this far. I think the appropriate thing is to let this go as a pilot, collect some data, see what's happening. Then the discussion in 2019 or further years out can actually be a productive discussion because we'll know what we're dealing with. Right now it's really quite hypothetical or anecdotal, and we don't have any numbers or statistics to tell us that we're on track or off track. But I think the case that Representative McLean brought is a great example of something that should get addressed.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I agree with Senator Lithicum. And also I think I'm going to presume here for a moment that Senator Dembrough was referring when he said he was sensitive to this bill's needs. What he was saying, I think, is that if we delay this, the kids that would otherwise benefit from it won't. And I think what probably Representative McLean was trying to do is say, hey, there are certain kids who would benefit from being able to participate in the activities offered at the public school, which currently they're not allowed to do so, and whether that's whatever it might be. I mean, there's any number of things. So if we choose to delay, we do so at the expense of those kids, and I suggest we don't delay. But if we go ahead with this bill, it needs to be really, really clear that there's a great deal of work that needs to be done to make this work in communities such as the Ontario community. You know that better than probably anybody else here, and it's just extraordinarily awkward. But we can't let that, you know, that situation with the parents and the administrators and everybody else interfere with the needs of the kids, and that's the truth of it. That's why I brought the bill. So anyway, so I would be supportive of it, but yeah, it needs a lot of work.
That has I appreciate those comments because that has been my driving force, and everybody out there knows that for me it's all about kids, and if we as the adults can figure it out, that's great, but at the end of the day we need to try to figure out how to make sure every kid gets every opportunity we can give them. And I don't care who's fighting for the dollars for that kid, I care about that individual kid, and I know it creates problems. It's caused problems for me in the past in my own school district, but the reality is when you look that kid in the eye, that's the most important thing in their life that moment, and then you say no for what they believe to be arbitrary rules that the adults are making, it's really hard, for me at least, and I don't know about everybody else. So.
Yeah. Although, Mr. Chair, if I can just add, I mean, the parents have decided to send the kid not to the public school.
I agree. They have not. For the most part, they have decided to send him to a different public school.
Yeah, okay. But I mean, to a charter school.
A public charter school. Yeah. In Oregon, there cannot be any others.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So, but not to the school that has the...
Right, that particular activity.
Things, right. Yeah. You know, I just, you know, again, I mean, I won't beat a dead horse, but I was actually... don't take this wrong, Morgan, but I was more supportive of this before, you know, I heard, you know, I mean, just what I'm hearing is that this bill just has so many questions that still need to be worked out, that it's kind of a classic bill that's not ready to go. And, you know, I mean, do we really pass a bill and create a program and then figure out afterwards? Usually we do it the other way around.
I would say that from a claims perspective, right. And I would agree with the perspective, we did have a lot of meetings to work out the issue with the high schools, lots and lots of meetings. And this doesn't change that. It just adds it to another group of people. The difference is that in the other one, we had OSA as an activity organization. We don't have that at the middle school level.
Mr. Chair.
I know you have to go. So.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
A couple things. First, someday I want Morgan to write a book about his life. Two, I'm disappointed you didn't talk about the sponge. It's been a long time since you talked about it. So three, I think given the questions that are here and the position that we put Morgan in and that we do have another day, maybe instead of working it today, we could carry it over and have
a
proponent of the bill come to the committee and tell us why we should pass it.
That would be great.
And there's not a floor session going on right now. I just checked.
Oh, I wonder why. I'm surprised then. So I have absolutely no problem with that. I've always had that conversation that they allow people to have a little extra time. It puts it a little later, but.
Wait, who said you could go?
Thank you, Morgan, very much. So we will carry the work session for, I've got to make sure I get it right, 4036A.
And before you drop the hammer, I want to mention, for purpose of the record, my law firm represents the school, not the charter school. So,
okay.
And so I want that clear. You'll note that my position is very probably contrary to my law firm's, but I'll call out the possibility of that being a conflict. And so at least everybody knows it now, and then it should be act upon it. I'll call out again.
Okay. So noted, and I appreciate that, too. So, so we will carry over the work session for House Bill 4036A. I will contact the sponsors of the bill from the House to have them be available for questions. And with that, I will close the public hearing and work session. I close them both. With the carrying over of the work session to Monday. And with that, we will open a public hearing because it's after 2. Mm-hmm. I knew we could get there. On House Bill 4067A, public hearing and possible work session. With that, we'll have a short explanation. We'll bring up Lori Kellogg, Leslie Sutton, and Dana Hepchin.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 4067A adds developmental delays to the list of conditions eligible for special education services for children in kindergarten through third grade. Establishes an effective date of July 1st, 2019.
Good afternoon, Senator Roblin and committee members. My name is Lori Kellogg. I'm an administrator with Early Intervention, Early Childhood Special Education with Northwest Regional ESD. And I also serve as a principal at Tualatin Early Childhood Center. Mm-hmm. I'm here to provide comments regarding House Bill 4067, extending the developmental delay eligibility through third grade. A little bit of background on this issue. In 1986, IDEA mandated services be extended to the early years because of the growing strong evidence on brain development. The developmental delay eligibility category was added at this time. Oregon used the most restrictive definition of DD that was allowed. In 1997, IDEA was reauthorized and made it possible for states to extend the DD eligibility through third grade, which is 8 years of age, which is consistent with brain research. Over 30 states have done this. Oregon did not choose to do this in 1997 because they were not sure of the impact. 20 years later, we now have experience and data and a desire to extend the DD eligibility through third grade. So, the anticipated impact. The transition to kindergarten is a critical time for kids and can set the trajectory for a child's educational experience. Continuity between EI-ECSE and K-12 can mean a smooth transition for students, and starting school on day one with the right supports and ready to learn. It can be difficult to determine an underlying disability in the early years because these young brains are developing at such a rapid pace. By extending the DD eligibility, school district personnel will have more time to gather information, to inform better decisions about the needs of children, and not forcing a decision about a categorical eligibility at 5 years of age. Children in kindergarten through third grade are still in that profound period of brain development for cognitive, social, and emotional growth. Some children lose the DD eligibility at this time, although could still benefit from supports, but do not qualify for other categorical eligibilities at the time of kindergarten. They lose the supports they need and have to experience academic failure, which often leads to negative self-esteem and the loss of valuable learning time before they are reevaluated. Some potential concerns. Increase in the number of students eligible for special education. The current reality, preliminary data in Oregon indicates there are small numbers of kids in Oregon statewide who are currently in this situation, approximately 200. National data on the 30 states who have done this show no increases. Other potential savings, third grade, better outcomes, and many exit special education. Eliminated the need to reevaluate children once they have struggled and failed in school. Another concern, school personnel may need some training on tools to evaluate for developmental delay. The current reality, by delaying implementation to 2019, ODE can provide the training and support needed. We anticipate this being minimal to none based on recent experiences with other states such as Wisconsin. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Leslie Sutton. I'm the policy director for the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities. We take direction from people experiencing intellectual and developmental disabilities and their families as we bring communities and people together. We believe that all children deserve supports and opportunities to succeed. My job here today is to tell you two stories. One is details a child who was not given opportunities to succeed in Oregon schools until he struggled without supports. This taught him to be disengaged, and he's disengaged today. The other story is a story of opportunity and an opportunity that Oregon has to continue to engage a child without allowing him to struggle first. So the House Early Childhood Committee heard from Heather Kernan, who is not available today to meet with you, but did give me permission to share her story. She moved here with her son and two other children from Arizona when her oldest son, Devin, was in second grade. He came from Arizona with special education eligibility under developmental delay, and she showed up as a parent empowered and ready to make sure that school was going to work for Devin. She brought the IEP and was very excited to get things rolling, and to her dismay was found out that Devin actually couldn't receive special education supports in Oregon because he had a developmental delay, and Oregon didn't recognize that as an eligibility criteria. So instead, what they did is they allowed Devin to be in school without supports, and he had never known school without supports. He was now in a new school, new friends, new social structure, and now no supports at all. And they were collecting data to see if he was eligible under another category of special education. And in fact, it took 6 months for them to find out that in fact he was eligible. And in that time, he had to fail publicly in front of his friends and his peers at school. And that was in second grade. By the time he hit fifth grade, he spent his entire fifth grade year in a therapeutic day treatment program. That's expensive. For everybody, socially, economically, and it was traumatic. And luckily now he's back on track, back in a general ed classroom, but he did have to take this detour that still weighs on him as far as if he's engaged as a student or not. And Heather reports that it's a struggle to keep him engaged in school because he's had such a negative experience. The second story I want to share today is a story of opportunity. My son, Miles, is actually 18 months old, and he experiences a developmental delay. He receives early intervention services, and like all parents, we really want to do anything we can to make sure that Miles succeeds. And a lot can happen between 18 months and 5 years old. We completely understand that. But success for Miles might mean using special education services as a developmental delay in our K-12 schools here in Oregon. And I can tell you that by allowing developmental delay as a category for special education here in Oregon, we're giving Miles the opportunity to use supports that are specific to what he may need so he can learn and grow along with his peers without having to struggle and ultimately fail before receiving those supports. And extending developmental delay eligibility means that Oregon is accepting and supporting Miles for what he needs and who he is as we know him today. And that's as a kid who's excited about a lot of things. He loves to whisper, yeah, that's his favorite thing. And, you know, by doing this, you're allowing him to have supports he needs so he can keep on saying, yeah, yeah, as he goes on. So thank you so much.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Dana Hepper. I'm the Director of Policy and Program for the Children's Institute, and we are also here in support of House Bill 4067. We've been working in collaboration with a number of other organizations on this piece of legislation for the past 6 months or more. And those organizations include FACT Oregon, the State Interagency Coordinating Council, which is the state-appointed advisory body on early intervention, early childhood special ed, Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities, Oregon Alliance for Early Intervention, and the Northwest Disability Services. And all of those organizations are supportive of the legislation before you today. I'll just quickly summarize, you know, we see benefits in this legislation for our students who aren't going to be forced to fit into another eligibility category at kindergarten in order to receive the wraparound supports they need. That we see benefits for parents. The transition to kindergarten is a stressful time for all parents, let alone a child who's experiencing disability and has been identified as a child with a disability, and just the added stress of having to figure out whether they're going to continue to receive the special education services they may need is an unnecessary added stress. And we've heard from a number of school district personnel that there are benefits in this for districts. It's quite a burden to reassess all of the children who are in the developmental delay category at kindergarten entry. This would allow them to spread those assessments out over time and get to know students better before they figure out which other disability category may be the best fit long-term if necessary. We also had this issue raised. Originally, the reason this bill was picked back up was because elementary school teachers came to a legislator town hall and said, we don't understand. We have kids in our class who are eligible for special ed in preschool, but they're not receiving special education services now. Why is this happening? So we're really eager to see this bill move forward. You probably noted it was unanimous in the House committee and House floor. And so we're looking forward to seeing this bill move through the Senate. In response to some concerns raised on the House side, we did move the effective date from July 1st, 2018 to July 1st, 2019. So that gives us a little bit more time to make sure districts have any training or support that they need and to a little bit better estimation on what we think potential impacts on student ed populations may be in the short term. Happy to answer questions.
Any questions? Senator Lithicum.
With regard to the bill before us, there's specific items. In most human service arenas, intellectual disability and developmental disability are categories we see a lot. In this subsection J in section 1.1, has specific learning disabilities, and then we've added to it a line that says developmental delay and calls out what sounds like a specific learning disability. I'm wondering what's the impetus for calling that out, and what are the other disabilities, specific disabilities that aren't called out, and what do those look like? So just I'm looking for your definitions and the hows and the whys for calling this item out. And I realize the example that you gave was having a child who was receiving help and benefits and support, and then all of a sudden by the age cutoff 10 is no longer receiving that. That makes sense, but I'm wondering why the call out.
It's actually five.
Yeah.
When they go into kindergarten, they lose it.
Oh, kindergarten, okay.
One of the things that we look at is a specific learning disability. At the age of five, that's nearly impossible to identify. Nearly impossible, because the children have not been exposed to academic curriculum. They've been in preschool, which is more a developmental experience. So some of the children that I have seen in my role, they have social and adaptive skill deficits. And those two categories fit under developmental delay. Those kids are difficult in classrooms. They have a hard time sitting still. They have a hard time attending. They can have quite an impact on a classroom if they go in without supports. As of right now, if their only areas of deficit are social and adaptive, there's no category that fits them for kindergarten. Because they're not severe enough to be ED, they don't have the cognitive deficits for ID. So we kind of say, go forth and do the best you can. And it's greatly unfortunate for those children who experience that.
So I would just add, for a number of the other special education categories, sometimes they're, in addition to experiencing a delay in learning, there may be another requirement around having a diagnosis. And so this is the category that says, you experience a delay in learning. We believe specialized instruction will help you close the gap with your peers. And we may not have a diagnostic category that best fits you at this time. And anyone who has spent time with young children, you know, development is so variable, especially in those early years, that we think if we give schools until third grade to figure out if there's a diagnostic category that fits, that's a better time frame in which to find that other diagnosis. So sometimes kids in this category, maybe they have ADHD, maybe they have high-functioning autism, maybe they have some anxiety they're managing, but it's hard to tell with a five-year-old exactly what is going on and whether long-term services will be needed, but we know they're needed right now. So my child, for example, receives special education under other health impairment, which is one of the diagnostic categories, but that required her to have an ADHD diagnosis, which even at six, when she was diagnosed, they're like, we think she has ADHD, that's probably what's going on, but it's a lot of six-year-olds are squirmy, a lot of six-year-olds have a hard time paying attention, so to be able to tell the difference between her and her peers at that young age is just really challenging, so this provides us a kind of more flexible category that doesn't necessarily require another diagnosis.
Yes, Senator Gelson.
I think the other thing that is really important to keep in mind about the words that are here, the lists, that you have to fit a category to come through the door. But once you come through the door for the eligibility, the IEP is based on what your needs are. So in this place for these kids, the words don't necessarily match, even though a kid that had a medical diagnosis would be eligible for the same services and they might present exactly the same way in a classroom. I think the other place that this, I think this is a really important bill, and what we're essentially doing are taking kids that we know need extra help, putting them in school for 3 years, forcing them to fail, in the meantime teaching them to hate school, not giving teachers or anybody else support. The kids are still in school. I mean, the same kids are still sitting in the same desks. We just aren't identifying what their support needs are. But the other place that this could help for kids that already are moving over, I know when my son, who's now an adult, was transitioning into from early intervention into kindergarten, we really did not want him to go in and start his school experience with a diagnosis of what we now call intellectual disability. But at that time, it was not just called mental retardation. His category was called trainably mentally retarded. And we were absolutely unwilling to do that. And sometimes I can be a little persistent. And we came up with, I think we came up with speech or language impairment, something that was very nonspecific, which he clearly was eligible. That became a problem down the line because, you know, in elementary school where we knew everybody, we met everybody, we just kept the same diagnosis. But he got to high school where he had six teachers in the day and they were totally unprepared when he walked through the door because they were expecting to meet a student that had a speech change or speech challenge rather than a student that had very significant complex and global needs. That all was driven by a decision we had to make in kindergarten, whereas if we could have called it developmental delay, by the time he got to third grade, we could have called it a specific learning disability, or we never would have been comfortable with the old words, but it would have helped him and it would have helped his staff as well.
Any other questions?
I'll just make a comment with regard to your point in the 427.005, intellectual disability is, quote, synonymous with mental retardation. That's still in code.
Correct, but we changed it. So the form when, and you have to remember these kids, they go, and before they ever walk into the classroom, the school gets a packet of information about them. They don't meet the child. So now, even though the statute describes what that used to be in the past, the teacher is not getting a piece of paper that has those words on. And we're working to remove that from every space in the code because it's outdated language. But yeah.
And as many of us know, labels stick in really negative ways most of the time. Well, tag doesn't always negative, but they do. They cause a lot of people to make internal decisions before they actually see the child. So.
And this is I think a much more non-specific, non-stigmatizing piece of language. I think the other reason it's important, I'm hearing from a lot of teachers in my district that have kindergarten and first graders that are having really significant behavior issues. And it's my belief, and I think science backs it up, that behavior issues, all behavior is a form of communication. And kind of being tossed into a big, busy classroom all day long where you can't move around anyway can make you pretty frustrated. And when you're 5 or 6, you don't have a lot of intellectual or verbal skills and tools to express your protest and your fear and your discomfort.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
We have one more person who didn't feel like he had gotten enough last time. So Morgan Allen.
Yeah. Chair, I want to put on notice I am supportive of this bill at this
ahead
moment.
Of time. That's true. I was concerned after what Senator Courtner had said on the floor yesterday why you would have changed, but that's okay. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Morgan Allen on behalf of COSA. And I do want to make clear that when we talk to our special education directors, they do support this policy change, and we appreciate the amendment on the House side to move the effective date so that it begins in the 2019-21 budget cycle. But I do want to put on the record, if you look at the fiscal impact statement, unfortunately, the actual number of students that would be impacted is unknown or indeterminate. And there's some guesstimates and estimates of maybe as many as 200 students coming in each cohort each year. So there's somewhere potentially between maybe on the low end 500 and on the high end 1,000 students in the K-3 cohorts that would potentially benefit from this. And our only request that we just want to put on the record is as we begin the K-12 budget process during the next biennium, it's really important that we work with ODE and get a good sense of how many kids there are, because as this gets folded into the state school fund, unfortunately, we have a cap on our special education funding in Oregon, which almost every district is over significantly. So the districts are most likely not going to get any additional state school fund to provide the IEPs and the services for these students. And we believe that we could, if we can work with the advocates and the sponsors and the Department of Education and get a good estimate, we could make a very reasonable budget request for 1921 that would allow bridge funding to transition in and make sure that our school districts are not having to shuffle their special education budgets to diminish potentially services to other kids to add these kids on. It should be additive, and we want to make sure that that's appropriately resourced. I don't know what that number is. It's probably somewhere in the, maybe $1 to $5 million range. And once it happens and gets built into the state school fund, it perpetuates itself in roll-up. But it's just something that our folks would like to put on the record. We support the change, but we do need to figure out how we're not just sort of reshuffling the pie in special education.
Okay. Questions?
A question and a comment. I've struggled with this point, and I've heard it a few times, because it's not as though we're bringing in kids to the classrooms that aren't already there. By definition, these are kids that don't have significant disabilities that are going to be requiring one-on-one assistance or self-contained classroom.
Right.
These are kids that are already in Mrs. Jones's kindergarten class or first grade class. So in my mind, the finance issue is one of where is that coming from? Because when kids have needs that are unmet, when they can't be successful and they don't feel safe and comfortable at school, that draws a need for resource, whether the kids are identified as special ed or not. I think that moving forward, we need to be looking at the increased pressures that we have in early childhood. We know that kids are coming. You know, we've spent a lot of time focusing on ready to learn as it relates to letters and numbers and shapes. We have kids that are coming that haven't had the opportunity to build the social skills and the interaction skills, and I worry that the focus on the academics means we're asking these kids to do things they are biologically and physiologically not designed to do, like be 5 years old and sit still for almost 6 hours a day. So I think we would do well to look at this age range and see, would our best investment be in more special education dollars? Would it be in more behavior specialists and teaching assistants in classrooms, more PE, more opportunities, and even looking at our standards in terms of what it is that we're expecting of 5, 6, and 7-year-olds who are really just itty-bitty tiny human beings that we are asking an enormous amount of, regardless of whether they have disabilities.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I agree with those points.
Okay. What? No argument? I can't believe it.
I was going to vote against this bill until Morgan came up and spoke.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Chair, I should put on the record that Morgan used to be a constituent of mine.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
And
is that a conflict or not?
And then he left.
Yeah.
Well, I should put on the record that Morgan's parents are still constituents of mine.
Oh, there we go. So,
Ernie,
I will entertain.
You and I are the only two who can vote on
this. That's right. It's getting down there. So
I would add, Mr. Chair, that Senator Linthicum is where my wife's family's from, Klamath County. So
oh, there. I guess I'm. It's
either.
You and I.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
I've got the committee pretty well covered.
So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we have already opened a work session. As long as I don't have any no votes, because I'm short two, if everybody's okay, then we will entertain a motion from Senator Linthicum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House Bill 4067A to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Linthicum moves House Bill 4067A to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any opposition? Motion passes, and Senator Gelser will carry. And that does the work. And I appreciate the conversations on each of these bills and the fact that we did hold over one of our bills. Because of that conversation, I think is a helpful thing. We'll hopefully get some more information from people. And with that, we are going to close the Education Committee on this February 21st. And, pardon?
Are we closing it?
Now, first we'll close the committee, the work session and hearing on Senate Bill 4067, and we'll close we will adjourn. Thank you. Thank you. We do have one more meeting, so I guess I can't close it. That's right. That might not be bad. We will adjourn today's meeting. Thank you very much, Senator Gelser, for that.